All right. Let's get into a deep dive on a case that really makes you think about attempted murder.
Oh, yeah.
It's a 1935 California Supreme Court case, People versus Miller.
Okay.
We got a stack of legal briefs and court documents,
Mm-hmm.
all the good stuff to like really break this down. The big question here is like, where do we draw the line between getting ready to commit a crime
Right.
and actually like attempting it?
Right.
And this case is wild because we've got a man who threatened to kill somebody, grabbed a rifle, went to where the person was working, but didn't get convicted of attempted murder.
Yeah, you would think that's a pretty open and shut case,
Yeah,
right?
like that's attempted murder, right?
Yeah. It's really fascinating because the court actually found that those actions weren't enough to actually say he was trying to commit the crime.
Yeah, so it seems really straightforward, but there's obviously a lot more nuance, right?
Yeah.
So, can you set the scene for us, like what was going on back in the 1930s?
Yeah, so we're in rural California, a town called Boonville, and our main character is this guy, Charles Miller. And he is convinced that this other guy, Albert Jeans, is harassing his wife. So Miller is angry, he's frustrated, he doesn't think the authorities are taking his concerns seriously.
So like we've got this like kind of love triangle going on,
Yeah.
and he's not just going to sit back, you know?
Exactly. And you have to remember, this is during the Prohibition era.
Oh, right.
So alcohol is everywhere. It's probably influencing this whole event. And actually, the court documents even say that Miller was intoxicated at the time.
So he's got the alcohol-fueled rage maybe going on.
Exactly.
So what happens next?
Well, Miller makes a very public threat that he's going to kill Jeans. Like, people at the local post office heard it.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't some, like, back alley whisper. This is like a real public declaration.
So we've got the intent, the I'm going to kill you part of the story. But you know, talk is cheap.
Exactly.
So did he take any steps towards making this threat a reality?
He did. Later that day, Miller actually gets a .22 caliber rifle and goes to a field where he knows Jeans is working. And there's actually another layer to this because a constable named Ginocchio is also present in the field.
Wait, so the intended victim and a law enforcement officer are there?
Yep.
That's complicated.
Yeah, it's a really interesting situation. And so you have to imagine this is a rural area. We're talking like wide open spaces. Miller doesn't try to sneak up on Jeans. He approaches from a distance about 200 yards away and stops. And he like appears to be loading the rifle. But here's the catch. He never actually aims it at Jeans.
Wait, so he gets the rifle, goes to the field, loads the gun, but doesn't point it at him. What was he doing?
That's the million-dollar question. So Jeans sees Miller with this rifle and understandably freaks out and runs away.
Right.
But Miller continues walking toward the constable, who then disarms him. The rifle's loaded, there's no question about that. But Miller doesn't resist.
Okay, so I'm getting really confused here. We've got the loaded gun. We've got this very public death threat. He goes to the field.
Right.
Like, it seems open and shut attempted murder.
You would think so, right?
Yeah.
But that's not what happened. So the jury initially found Miller guilty of attempted murder. But get this, the California Supreme Court actually overturned the conviction.
Wait, what? How?
I know, right?
Ugh.
He threatened to kill him. He had a loaded gun. He went to the field where he was working.
Yeah.
What more do you need? Well, this is where the law gets really specific. In California, to be convicted of attempted murder, you need two things. First, you have to prove what's called specific intent, meaning Miller had to actually want to kill Jeans, not just scare him, threaten him, like he had to actually intend to kill him.
Right.
And then second, you have to prove what's called a direct ineffectual act towards committing that crime. So it's not enough to prepare for it. You have to actually take a concrete step toward actually killing somebody.
Okay, I think I'm starting to see where this is going.
Right.
So he obviously had the intent, right, because he made that threat.
Right.
But what about this direct ineffectual act? What does that mean? Like, what kind of action would make it an actual attempt?
Yeah, so the court actually said that Miller's actions, while threatening, didn't actually cross that line. So getting the rifle, walking towards Jeans, that was considered preparation. He hadn't actually started to commit the crime. Think about it this way. You decide you want to bake a cake, right? You buy a cookbook, you buy flour, sugar, whatever. That's preparation. But have you actually started baking the cake? Not yet. You have to like preheat the oven, mix the ingredients, pour the batter in a pan. Like that's the direct act.
So in Miller's case, getting the rifle and going to the field is like buying the cookbook.
Exactly.
But he never preheated the oven or mixed the batter.
Exactly. So loading the rifle, even walking towards Jeans, wasn't enough. The court called his actions equivocal, meaning they could be interpreted in a few different ways.
Yeah.
Was he going to actually shoot? Was he just trying to scare James? Maybe he was trying to get the constable's attention so he could intervene.
Okay.
We just don't know.
So basically, he never took that final step, like the turn the oven on moment.
Yeah.
That would prove that he was trying to actually kill James.
Exactly. And the court was really clear about this distinction between preparation and an actual attempt.
Okay.
They even said if Miller had raised the rifle, taken aim, but was tackled before firing.
Okay.
That likely would have been considered attempted murder because that action is way more direct.
Oh, wow. There's such a fine line. So what you're saying is like it was the lack of that final action that really saved him from the conviction.
Exactly. Mm. And this distinction is still really relevant today, especially when you think about our digital age. Like just think about all the threats that are made online. Prosecutors need evidence of both intent and some kind of outward physical act to prove attempted crime.
So in Miller's case, he had the intent, but he didn't have that clear physical act that showed that he was actually going to shoot.
Right. Now, there's another interesting wrinkle to this case.
Hold on. Before we move on to that wrinkle.
Yeah.
I think we need to unpack this idea of intent a little bit further.
Okay.
Like, what does it actually mean to have specific intent to commit a crime?
Right.
And how you prove that in court?
That is a great question. Proving intent can be tough.
Yeah.
It's about getting inside somebody's head right.
Right. But the law can't just rely on mind reading. So how do they do it? What kind of evidence are they looking for?
Yeah. Well, you have to kind of think of it like building a puzzle, right? You need different pieces to form the whole picture. So in a case like Miller's, the prosecution's going to be looking at things like statements, actions, any sort of planning or premeditation, and even the motive behind it all.
So in this case, Miller's public threat would be a pretty strong piece of that puzzle, right?
Definitely. It wasn't just some offhand comment, you know, especially given the context of everything else that was going on. But the court actually made this really crucial distinction.
Okay.
They said intent actually has to be proven separately for the attempted crime itself.
Okay.
So you can't just assume somebody intended to kill somebody just because they were doing something else illegal, like in this case, having a loaded gun.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Right.
Because that would almost be like punishing him for a crime he didn't intend to commit.
Exactly.
Even if he was breaking the law in another way.
The court wanted to make sure that Miller wasn't being punished for just having that loaded gun, but for specifically wanting to use it to kill Jeans.
Okay. So you mentioned before that there was another interesting wrinkle to this case.
Oh, yeah. You remember how the jury was initially instructed?
Yeah.
That they could, like, presume intent simply because Miller was doing something illegal carrying the loaded gun?
Right.
Well, the California Supreme Court stepped in and was like, that's not how it works.
So they were saying you can't just assume he intended to kill him just because he was breaking the law.
Exactly. The court was really emphasizing that intent has to be proven separately.
Yeah.
Specifically for the attempted crime. You can't just like lump it in with other illegal things.
Right.
It's a separate thing you got to prove.
So it almost sounds like they were really trying to protect Miller's rights.
Yeah.
And make sure that he wasn't convicted based on assumptions or like faulty logic.
Right. They were guarding against what we call constructive intent.
Constructive intent.
Yeah, it's basically where you're holding somebody responsible for something they didn't actually want to do.
Okay.
So like think of it this way. Imagine you're swinging your arms around playfully.
Okay.
And you accidentally hit somebody.
Okay.
You didn't intend to hurt them, but the law might still hold you responsible because it was a reckless action. That's kind of like constructive intent. You're held responsible even though you didn't intend for that consequence to happen.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Right.
That makes a lot more sense. So they were basically saying that you can't just assume he intended to kill him because he had a loaded gun.
Right.
You have to prove he had the specific intent to actually use it to commit murder.
Absolutely. And that's why this case is so important for lawyers and law students.
Mm-hmm.
It provides a framework for thinking about these issues. Like, how do you analyze evidence? How do you create arguments in cases where somebody might be trying to commit a crime? But there's also another side to this case that we need to explore. Not everybody agrees with the court's decision.
Really? There were people who disagreed.
Yeah. There are some legal scholars and practitioners who think that the ruling sets the bar too high for proving attempted crimes.
Okay.
Their argument is that it makes it too difficult to prosecute people who are dangerous.
Right.
People who might be willing to commit violence, even if they haven't taken that final decisive step.
I kind of get it right. Like, he did threaten Jeans. He got a loaded rifle. He went to the field.
Right.
Maybe that is enough to show that he's a threat.
And they point to the model penal code as another way of looking at attempt.
Okay, what's the model penal code?
So instead of requiring a direct ineffectual act like California does,
okay,
the model penal code looks at whether the person took a substantial step towards actually committing the crime.
So what's a substantial step? How is that different?
It's any action that really backs up that person's intent to commit the crime.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be the final act before it's done, but it has to be more than just preparation.
Right.
It has to show that they are really moving towards committing a crime.
So under the model penal code, even though Miller didn't raise the rifle,
right,
the fact that he went to the field with the loaded gun, knowing Jeans was there and having already made that threat, that could potentially be seen as a substantial step.
It's possible. Yeah. It's just a broader view of what counts as an attempt. And it sort of recognizes that sometimes the circumstances around an action
right.
can be just as important as the actions themselves.
Okay.
In figuring out if somebody was truly trying to do something.
So we kind of have this tension then between stricter interpretations, like in the Miller case,
right,
that focus on those specific acts.
Right.
And a broader interpretation, like the model penal code, that looks at the bigger picture.
Exactly.
And if the person took any step at all towards committing the crime.
And this debate is ongoing even today. Different places have adopted different approaches, and there's no, like, right answer.
Right.
It often comes down to weighing this need to protect people from harm with the right of individuals.
Yeah.
To not be punished for thoughts or actions that haven't actually hurt anybody.
Right.
It's a balancing act.
It's so interesting how this one case, People versus Miller, has sparked all this discussion and debate about what it means to attempt a crime. It really makes you think about, you know, this balance between preventing harm and protecting individual rights.
Yeah, it's a really important issue. But, you know, how does the Miller case affect us today, almost a century later?
Yeah, things have changed so much.
Right. Especially with technology and cybercrime.
It does seem like the line could be even blurrier now with technology, right?
Yeah, you're right. Miller is actually still cited today in cases about, like, online threats.
Oh, wow.
Harassment,
okay.
Cyber stalking, things like that.
So how does a case from the 1930s with rifles and, you know, rural settings apply to something like, you know, death threats sent through a social media app?
Yeah, it all comes back to that same principle, you know, distinguishing between thoughts and actions. So just like having the loaded rifle wasn't enough to convict Miller.
Okay.
Just writing something threatening online might not be enough to be an actual crime.
So, like, what would make an online threat cross the line?
Yeah.
Does somebody have to say, like, I'm on my way to your house right now to kill you?
Well, it's not always that clear cut.
Right?
The courts often look at all the circumstances like they did with Miller.
Okay.
So they would consider things like the specific language used,
yeah,
how often the threats are made, how serious they are.
Okay.
Any other actions that the person is taking, and if there's any indication that they have the ability and the intent to actually follow through on the threat.
So it's like you're piecing together that puzzle.
Exact.
To see, is this a real credible threat, or is this just somebody you know blowing off steam?
Exactly. And this is where Miller is still so relevant, because it sets a precedent that protects people from being punished for just their thoughts or their words,
right,
no matter how bad they are. There has to be evidence of an actual plan and actions taken to make that plan happen.
It's fascinating how a case from so long ago still impacts the law today.
Yeah, it really shows how powerful legal precedent is. And you know, these foundational cases are so important.
Right.
They help us deal with these complicated issues even as the world changes.
This whole deep dive has been really eye-opening. I feel like I have a much better understanding of, you know, this landmark case and what it means for the legal system.
Yeah, it's been great to explore these issues with you.
Yeah.
Hopefully our listeners found it interesting too.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. So to wrap things up, what's like the big takeaway here? What should our listeners remember about People versus Miller?
The law punishes actions, not just thoughts. You can think about doing something illegal. You can even talk about it. But to be found guilty of actually attempting to do it, you have to take real steps towards actually doing it.
Okay.
And those steps have to be more than just getting ready. They have to be clear actions that show you're on your way to committing the crime.
And even then, like, context matters.
Yeah. Right?
It's a specific situation, the intent, all of it, you know, factors in.
Exactly. People versus Miller really reminds us that the law is this complex, fascinating thing that's always changing and always challenging us to think critically.
Well said. I think it's time to wrap up this deep dive. Thanks for joining us on this journey into the world of attempted crimes.
Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp.